This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. Building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Hey, Walter. Not a moment out of turn. The future of our country, and it I was a bit sad that it hadn't been raised yet, but it really is the people and it's the young people. And the young people here are just incredible when you contrast them with elsewhere in the world. But I want to get it a bit specific now. We buy cars. There's Dirk over there. Tell us how you, because this will give us a good understanding of how your brain works in making investments.
Well, I'm talking to my book. I think we own 5% of WeBuyCars. We were always heavy investors in transaction capital. And we bought it very early in the early days from Mark Lamberti. It was his stake. And we rode from about $4.75 all the way to $50. And of course, it was three different businesses. And one of them was WeBuyCars in the end. At the time we bought TC, it was no WeBuyCars. And there was bad luck. The taxi business was strikes in KZN. There were the floods, so you couldn't buy Toyotas. And the collateral going forward wasn't enough for the loans, and the taxi business went bust. But they bought WeBuyCars. And in this mess, you can imagine now, we had basically given most of our money back that we had made. We hadn't lost money, but our minds were a bit jaded. And we had kept on learning about WeBuyCars, and it felt like there was something new here. And to cut a long story short, I think it was one of our competitors said, this is the Capitec of South Africa, the next Capitec. And we kind of paid attention to that. And and typically you never want to participate in an IPO because the price is going to be wrong. It's an auction. This was a forced auction. So the price was going to be wrong. The listing was for the wrong reasons. So you've got a wonderful business with the owners still on board, and they've been forced to sell. And we thought we'd go in at $23.75, I think. And they gave it to us at $17.75, and we made pigs of ourselves. We couldn't get enough. They gave us more than what we asked. We kept on asking for more and more from TC. And the more we got to know this business, it's those things that I'm talking about in that presentation. You've got these shareholders, or these owner-managed shareholders, driving a business with passion and honesty and integrity. You can't go wrong if you've got that. You know, yes, you can. There's always bad luck in investments. So we've held on to our WeBuyCars, and I'm sure it's expensive at the moment.
What's the price now?
It's about 54 rand.
So 17, 7. And how long was that?
I don't know, Fawn. You'll tell me. 2 years about, yeah. April, yeah. And it just goes from, and the news gets better and better. You know, no one was speaking about AI 2 years ago. You know, and this is the wonderful thing about great assets, is you're not going to tell the future. You know, but great companies will surprise you with something new. And I think this is going to be one of them. And one doesn't want to dream too much. So I don't want to share too much what I think the future will look like. But it's a keeper for me. And I always say there are roses in the portfolio and there are weeds. And I never want to pull the roses out. I'd rather pull the weeds out. And we fund managers are too active. We always want to show that we're doing something. And at Aylett & Co, we don't change our funds for 10 years. It's an 8% turnover, which is, we're not stockbrokers' friends. They hate us. So I think if you think like owners and you go for the long run, you do much better. It's much easier. You're a bit like the tortoise in the race where everyone else saw rabbits. Does that answer it?
It does. It does, very much so. I think the whole idea of integrity, honesty, the right management, it's something that gets lost in the noise.
You know, often. You can look at the model. You know exactly in the back of a cigarette box what they've done every month. You know the numbers. It's not hard. So, you know, as long as they stick to the formula, as long as they stick to what they told us and have the support of us as shareholders, it's going to be just fine.
What did you think of what Stafford had to say about Bitcoin?
I when I was sitting there, I was thinking of Charlie Munger, and I don't want to talk about my religion. It's not going to be good.
Okay. Okay. Didn't he call it, he called Bitcoin rat poison or something? Look, there are two sides to every story.
To get me into this discussion.
Okay, you're not getting into this discussion. Okay,
I have to look after people's money.
Somebody was talking a bit earlier about how in America, in the Midwest,
yes,
it's wholesome. I love that description, wholesome. Is that what defines the guys in Omaha and indeed the way that you approach life and investing?
Yeah, look, we can't be like Buffett and Munger. They got permanent capital. They're a lot cleverer. But it's the folksy Midwest, you know. I'll never forget, I once went, they've got all these sayings and these, and they've been brought up that way. And I'll never forget, I walked there, I got in once and I was walking around Omaha. And you meet someone, he's this tall guy with a big cowboy hat and shakes your hand, and we are talking. He says, "You know, sir, you look like a guy who shovels his own snow." As you don't talk shit, and I think that just says a lot. And then I got to know, if you know Wally Watts, he's a director now of Berkshire. I mean, there was this guy Wally Watts, and I thought I'd go look him up. He ran an asset management or vice funds. He made quite a lot of money for me as well. These are the heroes that I keep on talking about. And another guy called Paul Luntzes, who worked for Sequoia. And Paul's just a fantastic analyst. He actually unofficially worked for Buffett. And I didn't know it at the time until he showed me a photograph. And he did a lot of insurance work for him. And so you meet these guys, and they are from Midwest. They trot is right. Just the way they live.
So what are you making of Donald Trump and what he's doing at the moment?
You know, I knew you were going to ask that question, so I prepared myself for it, if you don't mind.
How did you know?
Well, it's such an easy answer because, and this was written by Ayn Rand. You remember?
Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand, sorry. And she said, and these were her words in 1905, "When you notice that to produce, you need to get permission from those who do not produce anything. When you check that the money flows to those who do not deal with goods but with favors. When you realize that many become rich by the bribery and for influence more than by your work, and that the laws do not protect you against them, but on the contrary, they are the ones who are protected against you. When you discover that corruption is rewarded and honesty becomes a self-sacrifice, then you can assert without fear of being wrong that your society is doomed." So I think she said that better than I do.
I was wondering whether Atlas Shrugged was a bit of a pre-documentary of Zimbabwe, but maybe now it looks like it could have been a pre-documentary of South Africa.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Atlas Shrugged?
No, I don't know that.
Ayn Rand?
Ayn Rand, oh, yes.
Atlas Shrugged?
Okay.
Did you read it?
No.
Okay.
I just read liked to what she said.
It's like a documentary.
Okay.
Of Zimbabwe. I always felt that it was just telling us what Zimbabwe was doing, but South Africa.
Well, you know, I think these things take longer to play out. And this thing started in 2008. It didn't start with Trump now. And Charlie wrote a wonderful op-ed piece, Washington Post. Basically, it's over. That was the title. And Charlie's smart. And I think, you know, we all go to America. First of all, I've been going to America for 20 years. I have family there. I've spent 1 month a year in America every year, at least. And I try to understand it, but because it's a world, it's not a country. And there are 50 countries in that world. But the conclusion that I've come to, it's all about money. Nothing else matters in the USA. And you can hypothesize, you can say what you like. Money is going to be the ultimate determinant of their future, and it doesn't look good. There's too much greed and too much debt and too much bad behavior. And they've forgotten why they're who they are. Now, Buffett says, don't bet against the American economy. I'm not betting. I'm just saying, I think history is on my side. Yeah, it just takes longer.
What did Charlie Munger say in that piece of his?
That the last 50 years of this declining interest rate environment from 82 and the wonderful machine of that American economy had made everyone so super wealthy was over. And you know, he was a great fan of China. And I think he's got it spot on. I think, you know, for investors, we are looking more and more towards Asia for the next 20, 30 years. That's not to say you can't make money in America. And you will be able to make money there, but it has to go through a washing out phase.
So I remember him talking about BYD long before anybody else knew about it. He was an investor.
Absolutely.
If you were advising the South African government, would you tell them to continue to turn their eyes eastward rather than westward?
Jeez, what do I know about stuff like that?
Well, you know what Charlie thought of it.
I tell you what I do think is that and Prince spoke about Singapore, and these are small countries, and we've got Rwanda up the road. Which is a benevolent dictator, and that really works. So I think if you have tough love in this country and you follow the Chinese model of tough love, it's not going to hurt us. But will the population take that? I don't know. You know, we can start with it. You know, 2010 in the World Cup, mm-hmm. Do you remember they had the courts and they had there was no problems. We can do it. And we start just with the taxis. And the citizens see that every morning, that there's good behavior encouraged. It starts like that. Tough love.
So you invest in We Buy Cars. You own 5% of that business, which would be a big chunk of your portfolio.
It's a big chunk, yeah.
Are there South African businesses?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many wonderful companies at the moment. Our country is so cheap, it's scary. Of course, you need the economy, you need confidence, you need certainty. And we don't know if that comes or not. But there's some very, very good companies. A company that I really, really like, but it's a bit full at the moment, is Storage. I think it's a wonderful solution. It's not a property company. And then there's assets like hospital groups and one particular, we're very big in spa, you know, and no one wants to buy spa at the moment. You know, they're too cheap. We own packages, little packages that are making very good money. There are a lot of cheap shares. There's just no doubt about it.
So how much do you have invested offshore?
Not as much as everyone else. We've decided the last 4 years to be more in South Africa. And what's really hurt our relative performance is not only Naspers and gold shares, which is fine. We've always been on record. But if we look at the underlying assets, like We Buy Cars, and we're about... You can go 45% offshore. We're about 30.
Talk about gold. Given that Bitcoin's off the radar, gold, according to Bitcoin, is the natural Bitcoin. So even they like gold at the moment.
You know, it's always easy to talk about something that's done well and one never talks about it when things aren't going so well. The problem I have with gold is I like income-producing assets. I do not like an asset where I'm hoping someone will buy it from me one day, like a picture. So, when the Kuwaitis were invaded by the Iraqis and there was this ton of gold in their central bank there, it happened so fast they couldn't take it with them. It's just too heavy. But if you can just transfer assets offshore very quickly, I saw gold losing its value in that respect as a store of value because you can't transport it anymore. And the Russians have discovered this problem. You know, if they've got gold in London, it's gone. It's not theirs anymore. And I think that is why gold is run primarily is that they don't want dollars and they're settling all their transactions with gold bullion. And the Chinese have been buying gold. But there's not enough gold in the world.
You got a lot of young people working with you, as you were saying earlier. How are they seeing the future?
Jeez, they don't think like us. You know, they are South African. They don't see the problems. We don't chase BEE money, so that's why we're not 100 billion. So we don't have those constraints of having to employ certain types of people. We want the best people to work for us. And of course, we would love to have more people of color and more females. We just can't simply find them. And we run a very different remuneration structure. You get 35,000 rand a month, and every 6 months you get a big bonus. So you act like a partnership. So they are rewarded in a meritocracy, and we get no help from the government. So we're on our own, yeah. And I think because you've got this collegial top atmosphere there, it's a wonderful business and wonderful people. Why would they want to go anywhere else?
We've got questions that you can send through. Steve Kellaway has got one here for you, Walter. Can you tell us about your investment philosophy and fund allocation structure?
Well, on the philosophical side, it's very easy. I mean, for us, which was a Buffett way of thinking, besides rational and common sense, above all, rule one is don't lose money. And rule two is don't forget rule one. And you lose money by overpaying for assets. So we are quite valuation focused. That doesn't mean we won't pay up for a very good business. But we need to be damn sure that that over the passage of time, which is a great risk reducer, if you give someone 10 years to make your money, you don't have much risk. As long as you don't overpay for the asset, you'll do just fine. In terms of fund allocation, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, I would presume that it means that how much do you have in different classes?
We've got four different mandates, but we mainly fully invested in equities between 75 and 80% in those like asset allocation funds. We're about 30 on a blended see-through basis, because you have a lot of dual listed here that are foreign companies like BAT. We're much closer to 60% offshore, if you think of it that way. Renet of 8% of our funds, which is essentially an offshore company. And then we've got quite a lot of, we had a lot of bonds. I mean, bonds has probably been our best investment for the last 2 years.
South African bonds.
Yeah, yeah. It's the easiest. I've been, the first time in 30 years that I've loved owning bonds, and it's done really well for us.
Tony Pitt said the same thing. He said It was a great asset class. Explain to people who don't know what bonds are, what they are, and why they're so appealing.
Well, the wonderful thing about it is that the government needs to borrow money, and they issue bonds, and because there's this perception that risk is very high in South Africa, they have to offer you a higher yield than the rest of the world. So at that stage, between 10 and 12%, inflation was running between 3 and 6. So you're getting a real return of well in excess of 6%. But on top of it, we knew that the government didn't have room to borrow more. There was a lot of pressure on the government, a lot of focus. And I mean, there were some hairy times when certain politicians said the wrong things, but it gave you another buying opportunity. And so as interest rates come down, because as the American bond market starts coming down, the gap is too big and it closes. And so not only do you make money on your interest, you make money on the capital, because now the yield has gone from 12 to say 9%. You've made about a 15 to 20% return in 1 year on essentially risk-free money. And this is the part that I find amazing. South Africans think banks are safer than the South African government. The best investment for an individual who doesn't have to worry about tax is the RSA savings bond, which is this treasury issues you a note. And you as an individual, as a public, for 5,000 Rand right up to 5 million Rand, you can earn, at once it was 10.25% fixed for 5 years. In 3 years. I mean, that's how, you don't have to worry about anything. And so now I don't trust the Southern government. Well, I've got news for you. If you can't trust them, you've got a problem with the bank. So there are these opportunities. And so, yeah, that's basically history behind bonds.
That's interesting, because Ashore Sarapin earlier today was saying the same thing. He was talking about, we talk about 12J, which the guys at Futureneers were invested in. It was a fantastic investment opportunity. Wonderful.
There's not enough of the
return. And then they closed it. There are a number of these little pockets, tax-free share accounts.
Yes. There's just not enough. And you're not being, not adjust inflation. So the 36,000 tax-free savings, if you can put your children from day one into that, they will never have to work after 55, because they'll get such tax-free growth on that. If you do the actual compounding numbers for 40 years, you have a very wealthy individual after that, because they don't pay tax and they can put it anywhere in the world.
So just
do the sums.
Just be patient, and that compounding interest is so useful.
James Rothman asks the question. He says, will Greg Abel and Ajit be able to fill Warren and Charlie's shoes, obviously at Berkshire Hathaway?
No one is going to fill Warren's shoes, and the business is not designed for that. Ajit is probably on his way out, so there's probably someone already, I think I know who it is, who's lined to take up the insurance side of the business. There's two candidates, one of the two T's, Ted and Todd, who are the fund managers with Buffett. And then, of course, you've got Greg, which I think is going to take over completely. And so I don't think it's one of those. There's so much underlying strength in people below that will do what they're responsible for, but at the end it's this Greg.
Okay, now I'm going to tell you something that probably nobody in this room knows. You know that I was quite, I got to know Howard Buffett quite well, Warren's son, and we had dinner with Howard in Omaha. Howard was involved here in South Africa with De Wild, with the Cheetah Farm. Yes. And in the engagement with him, Eskom was going through the initial start of its problems. Yes. There was a guy here called Dr. Steve Leonard, and I put them in touch with Berkshire Hathaway, and they had conversations for Berkshire Hathaway to come in and assist or purchase or do something with Eskom. Now we're talking before the shit hit the fan.
Yes.
Had that happened, give us a scenario of what would have, could have occurred in South Africa.
Well, I've no doubt that we wouldn't be in the position we're today if private could run it. But on the energy side of the business, Buffett and Greg have always been return focused, and they will not go into a project where they're not being rewarded adequately. So they would never come here on a philanthropic basis. They would have come here as capitalists, and I don't know if that would have worked. But in terms of the solution, no doubt about it, they would have resolved it. I'll tell you an interesting story about Howard, if I can. So 2 years ago, it was 2 years ago, we go to Omaha, and there's this man in the breakfast room. You know, these hotels are terrible. They're really one-star hotels. And one of my analysts says, did you see him? I said, see who? He says, no, man, that's the world boxing champion. So I look there, and he's this huge man. And literally, his hands are like coming out, yeah. And he says, that's Klitschko. I said, who's the hell's Klitschko? He says, no, he's the Ukrainian. His brother's the mayor of Kiev, and that's him. Oh, okay. So we go up the lift, and next morning I'm going down for breakfast, and there he is again. And I look, he's going for a run at 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning. Are we going to go and have breakfast? Myself and Kimon, my son, who wrote the book. I said to him, Kimon, go and ask him to sign your book. He says, what do you mean? I said, how many times do you meet a Russian boxer, a Ukrainian boxer at Omaha? Go and ask him. He's famous. So he takes this blue book and walks over to me, and here's this giant of a man eating his pastasties, cornflakes on a polystyrene plate. Like this. He says, excuse me. He looks, now I can't hear them. I'm over there. I can just see them. He says, yeah. He says, Mr. Klitschko. And I came on being humble, and he does like this with the book. He says, do you mind if you sign my book? He says, you want me to sign your book? What is this book? He says, no, I wrote a book about Warren Buffett. He says, give me this book. Takes it and looks. He says, I want this book.
So, he didn't say no.
So Kim says, yeah. And then they've become the greatest of friends. They talk to each other. He runs a family office in London. But why I'm telling you this story, he says, but I think you must sign book for me. Anyway. It turns out that Howard brought him over and had given him well in excess of hundreds of millions of dollars to fight the Russians. And he said, you have no idea how good Howard Buffett has been to us. So that's the story. You meet the right heroes.
I don't know if he still is, but he used to be a permanent resident of South Africa, Howard.
I think he spent 6 months in that game reserve in North Pretoria. I know he fought a lot with a client of mine.
You fought a lot with the government too. Yeah. Anyway, but it just shows you what we've been saying throughout here, that this country has just got it's got the greatest friends and the greatest potential.
If you just take tourism, I mean, I was in Greece now. You see the volumes of tourists coming through. And when I'm staying at a hotel, yeah, it's just tourists. You build the roads, you build the trains, you build the, and we can be a service industry. You don't need highly competent people to work hard in services and be pleasant. Our people are pleasant. It's wide open, but sort out the safety.
Do you pay much attention to politics?
Yes and no. I think I'm pretty well informed, particularly now with podcasts and trying to do facts and not emotions. I'm not too particularly good on South African politics. I'm very good on foreign politics.
But you invest heavily in South Africa.
It doesn't bother me at all.
Why?
Because I build enough margin of safety into my thinking. So if I'm buying something on a yield of 25%, which is a 4 PE, I don't have to worry about the risk of the country. And I've invested in Indonesia on that basis, China. We're very big in casinos in Macau. We have a chocolate company in Indonesia. It's a PE of 4-5. You have to think like it because you don't know the lie of the land. You know how the businesses make money, but there's so much unknown and you've got to price that risk in.
Explain that margin of safety.
So, for example, say you want to build a bridge over a farm river, one of those rivers, and I say to you, build a bridge, it'll take a 20-ton truck. You're going to ask me how high is that bridge. And if it's one of those flood bridges, you know, it doesn't matter if the bridge collapses under the weight of the truck, no one's going to die. But if that bridge is 100 meters in the air, you need a lot of safety in the engineering. Investments are the same. You go through a process, and if you're wrong on your investment, you get your money back. So you want optionality, and you try and make sure there's no debt on the balance sheet or stuff that hasn't been mentioned, that there is some pricing power in the product. So like a steel company doesn't offer you that. There are so many businesses which I say go into the too tough tray. They're just away. They can't give you that margin of safety. And you want to invest in companies that when the unknown happens, the management can cope with the unknown and haven't overpaid for that asset. And because you've got time on your side, as 10 years, they've got all the time in the world to fix the problem and also in create new projects you never knew. There's a company in Greece called Jumbo Retail, that we've invested since 2010, I think. We paid 250 euros for it at the time. It's now 32 euros, but it's given us dividends of well in excess of 10 to 15 euros. So in retail, it's a 5 euro store. Everything you buy is less than 5 euros. But we didn't know they would go into Israel, Romania, Bulgaria. You know, we always saw them as a Greek company. And the distribution assets were less than they were worth more than the share price, just the assets. So for us, the margin of safety was massive in the crisis of Greece.
Have you sold any of those shares?
I haven't sold Jumbo. I've sold the tobacco company and the property company were forced to, someone mentioned Fairfax, they stole it from us. with a property company in Greece. We bought the most unbelievable property assets in Greece in the crisis. There were logistics assets, office assets, and few retail assets. No residence, no big office property.
But the point I'm getting to is with Jumbo,
yeah,
it's now a 15-bagger,
yes,
in your portfolio.
Yeah.
It would be a much, much bigger share of your portfolio, one presumes.
It did, and that was the mistake we made because we were scared that if we lost money in Greece, our clients would say, why did you go to Greece? So our inexperience kicked in. We should have been 5% Jumbo, not 1 or 0.5%.
Would you have stayed, though, with those, even though it's up 15 times?
In certain products that we got mandates to do that, yes. So a good example is we buy cars. We have not sold shares.
And you have no intention of?
Not at the moment. I can't find anything better to buy of that quality. I know it's overvalued, but it's fine. Well, I'm not in and out.
And one final question, and it really has been a fascinating conversation. When you buy into businesses, do you differentiate between owner-managed and manager-managed? Professionally managed, i.e.?
The very big companies aren't really manager-manager. Berkshire's an exception. But like when we own a big stake, it's interesting. I was talking about Bitcoin and all these AI things. I just think of so much copper is going to be needed. You know, so please carry on talking about Bitcoin and all these miners, because they need the copper, and BHP Billiton is the world class lowest cost producer in copper. So I think there's no owner managed person. It's a manager, professional manager, and so you won't be able to apply that. But they need to act like they are owners. The shareholders have to be aligned. If they're not, in an owner managed driven, it's typically a smaller company, and management still own 40% or 10%, and that's the only.
If you like copper, do you like Anglos now with this new tip?
I think it's a wonderful deal. Anglos have done everything right. I think we're going to have two of the best assets in the world there.
Walter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, South Africa's leading boutique wealth manager. Trusted to guide families for over 20 years. Invest better with Brenthurst.